Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What's being served in your children's school cafeterias? And if you or they don't like the food, what can you do about it? Between kindergarten and senior year, the average student will eat about 3,000 meals at school and formulate ideas about what a proper lunch should consist of. So why are so few school nutrition programs taking full advantage of the opportunity to educate kids about healthful eating while satisfying their hunger? 4 years ago, Amy Califa produced a documentary called Two Angry Moms about the less-than-ideal offerings in many school cafeterias. Since then, she's been flooded with questions from fellow parents who agree there is a problem with campus cuisine but aren't quite sure how to address it. She offers some answers in her new book, Lunch Wars, How to Start a School Food Revolution and Win the Battle for Our Children's Health. Amy, welcome to Think.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show, Chris.
So what can be found in school lunches that parents ought to be worried about?
I encourage all parents to go to school, have lunch with your kids. If they're elementary school students, they'll probably be excited about it. Older kids, it's maybe better to go with a group of parents, and definitely let your food service director or your school administrators know that you're coming in, and you have to see for yourself what the kids are eating in the cafeteria. There may be healthy choices, and those healthy choices are probably competed with by a lot of really unhealthy choices. And even the stuff that sounds healthy, that has healthy-sounding names, when I went through my daughter's cafeteria, I found that many of those items had ingredients in them that I really don't think kids should be eating on a daily basis.
So they come home and say they had yogurt at lunch, and then you find out it's full of flavors and colors and high-fructose corn syrup.
Exactly, and it's got a really, it sounds healthy, and kids assume, especially, middle school girls, yogurt's a healthy choice, right? Mm-hmm. So, they don't even realize. And many of the people working in the cafeteria don't even realize that the ingredients in a lot of these foods just are not good to serve to kids on a daily basis. Then there's the obvious stuff like the corn dogs and the pizza and the giant pretzels and all the cookies. And those things are very often way out of proportion. And nobody in the cafeteria is minding the kids and suggesting that maybe they shouldn't make a lunch out of those items, that they should, be something that might supplement a healthy lunch.
The other thing that's important to point out is that what's left off of school menus is often locally sourced food and things that are prepared fresh and free of additives. There's a lot comes in on a truck in a big can.
Yes, exactly. And this is what the school food revolution is about. It's finding ways to connect the cafeteria with the classroom learning and with locally sourced products and ingredients. It's a great thing for a local economy. Local farmers love to find schools as customers because it's a steady kind of a supply, and they feel really good about doing something good for the kids. So these kinds of things are going on now in school districts across the country with farm-to-school programs, school gardens, and it's a whole different way of looking at school food.
What have we learned about the relationship between proper nutrition and student achievement?
Oh, my goodness. Well, some of it, I think, is really obvious. Any teacher will tell you that kids who tank up on sugary stuff at lunchtime are impossible to teach after lunch. They get that sugar high, and then they crash, and they're falling asleep on their desks after lunchtime. So that's, an obvious thing. But beyond that, there are many, many studies out now, and I cited many of them in the book, that connect, not just proper nutrition, but real kids who eat real, whole, freshly prepared, healthy foods do better in school. They're more socially integrated. They perform better at athletics. And they have fewer absent days. So it's really a win-win for all aspects of the educational environment.
So many schools have done away with recess altogether, which is something that a lot of parents lament. Talk first of all about how parents can work to get a few minutes at least of playtime back into the school day.
Well, there's an interesting thing that a lot of parents aren't aware of, and that is that the USDA, which runs the whole school food system, requires that every school district that participates in the school meal program have what's called a wellness policy, and that sounds kind of boring and dry, and sometimes the meetings that form that policy can be, but it's really an opportunity for parents to advocate locally on behalf of their kids and create nutritional guidelines, really food guidelines in that policy. I have examples of some wonderful policies in the book. A lot of the policies that exist now across the country are just rubber stamps of guidelines, and they don't have specifications. But if you want your school to source from local farmers, you can actually write that into the food policy of the wellness program, and then whoever's providing the school meals will be required to do that contractually.
But in terms of just time for recess in schools, talk a little bit about that. You mentioned there are some schools that do have some recess, and they've learned that putting the recess before the meal is helpful.
Yes, exactly. That's something that's been studied, and there's a whole movement of recess before lunch for a couple reasons. First of all, if kids run around, they get hungry, mm-hmm. so they kind of get their ya-yas out. Then they're also more focused when they get into the cafeteria on eating. When they're antsy and they've been sitting in class all day, and then you put them in the cafeteria and say, okay, you've got a choice. Many schools do this, a choice between lunch or recess. You know, you have a half an hour for both. They'll gobble down something. They won't bother to go in the lunch line. They'll do a grab-and-go item, and they'll run outside. And, you know, in the case of my daughter's school, they were having lunch first, but after 15 minutes of lunch, they were being literally thrown out of the cafeteria mm-hmm. into recess, even if they were still eating their lunch. So recess before lunch is highly recommended by all health professionals.
And 15 minutes doesn't sound like a lot of time. My kids have come home and reported that by the time they got through the line, you know, they had sometimes 5 minutes to eat.
Exactly. Yeah, it's not a lot of time. And this is, you know, one of those areas that's really an opportunity that's not being taken to teach kids. So what we're doing is we're giving kids a message that eating, taking your time, chewing your food, maybe having a nice conversation over lunch, and then sitting at the table a little while to get your, you know, just have your digestion begin is not important, that we should just eat as fast as we can and go run off and do something else. So this is very unhealthy, and we should not be teaching kids that this is an okay way to approach their meals.
So many people are concerned these days about the rise in childhood obesity we've seen over the past couple of decades. And as you explain it, American kids these days are often overfed and undernourished. Yeah. What part do school lunches play in all that?
Oh, my gosh. Well, a huge part. You know, the school lunch program is a social welfare program. It was started after World War II because so many would-be soldiers were so malnourished that they didn't qualify for military service. So the federal government began subsidizing meals. They were subsidizing farmers to grow food for the Army, and then they took those subsidies and put them into the school lunch program. And that essentially is still how it is today. So the schools, you know, is a manifestation of the government taking responsibility to grow healthy soldiers, mm-hmm. If you want. And we still see that problem today. It's a different way of showing itself, but these people many people who suffer from obesity are hungry. They're literally hungry and they're starving, and especially kids who have growing bodies and need nourishment, they're not getting the nourishment they need in their food, so they're eating more. A lot of processed foods just don't nourish kids in a balanced way, so they're hungry. And the other thing is we're seeing our soils being depleted much more than they were a generation or two ago. So an apple or a potato that you're eating today has sometimes half or a quarter of the nutrition that it did in the past. So you might have to eat four apples today to get the equivalent nutrition of an apple in the past. These kinds of things have to be looked at from an educational standpoint because it's so important to nourish our children's bodies as well as their minds. And school is a place where we educate. So we need to start teaching kids about their food and getting them connected to it in the classroom.
Amy, when you talk about subsidies for school lunch programs and the USDA, many people are aware that tax dollars are going into these programs. But from the perspective of school districts, they're operating on incredibly tight budgets when they're making meals, so that even when lunches might cost $2 or $3 a piece, sometimes they have a dollar to actually spend on the food itself.
Yeah, it's a very complicated system because they are feeding so many children on a massive scale across the country, and it is costly. We spend about $9 billion a year on school meals. That's the government side. And as you said, only about $1 per meal covers the cost of food, and that has to include milk, which is usually 25 cents. So your food service director has about 75 cents to provide what we consider a healthy meal for children. That's a challenge and nearly impossible in any part of the country. So this is why we really have to turn to people who are very creative to be in these positions. A lot of school districts that I covered in the book are hiring chefs who know how to supplement the government subsidies with ways that will grow the school food program. You know, they're required to be self-sufficient. I know one chef in Massachusetts who actually has kids helping him make soup out of ingredients that they've grown in school gardens and from the farmers market, and he sells these soups at the local farmers markets, and he's raising a lot of money that goes back into his meal program, so he's able to buy better ingredients. So it's creativity is what we're seeing right now.
What about the argument that you can put salad bars and healthy fresh foods into schools, but they simply don't, kids don't want meals that are better for them than, say, chicken nuggets and fries?
You know, that's one of those arguments that it's true if you believe it's true, and it's not true if you don't believe it's not true. If you give a kid a choice between a nugget and a salad, well, if they're used to eating nuggets, and, you know, let's put it this way, school food is really a reflection of American food culture in general, where we have special foods for kids, and that often involves nuggets and fries. And if that's what a child's used to eating, that's what they're going to choose. So if we turn this into an educational opportunity and say, gee, wouldn't it be great if kids learned to eat other foods that aren't nuggets and fries, and we started doing that at an early age, we can actually develop their taste buds so that they'll have a preference for healthier, fresh items. And I've seen that happen in many places in the United States, and particularly in countries like France, where it's their dominant food culture. So the kids in France from kindergarten eat a four-course lunch, and it might begin with a beet salad, which is something I've rarely seen an American child eat, but those kids love it. So it's an education.
So I guess that what you do is, instead of saying, okay, choose between a green salad and chicken nuggets, you say choose between a green salad and a fruit salad.
Exactly. And there are schools, and we're talking about wealthy districts and districts that have high poverty levels, so this isn't really an elitist movement, which sometimes I've heard it accused as that. There's an example in New Haven, Connecticut, where Chef Tim Cipriano, he calls himself the local food dude, is in charge of that school district, and the first thing he changed is limiting the choices so that there's only one or two choices, but they're healthy choices. The kids don't have to make that choice between the Pop-Tart and the nugget. They're choosing between a couple of healthy entrees, and it's made a world of difference there.
And are they selling the same amount of food? Because there's still the issue of having to bring in a certain amount of revenue.
Absolutely. You know, one of the statistics that I found, and it has been studied, is that when schools make changes to healthier food, the first 6 weeks of the program, the food service directors throw their arms in the air and say, see, I told you it wouldn't work, and the sales fall off, and they get very worried about those revenues. Within 6 weeks, these revenues increase and in almost every case go on to surpass the levels that they were previously. Now that's with education and with getting the kids to taste new foods. And they're finding in some cases that the sales are doubling and tripling because kids who weren't buying lunch at school are now participating, and so is the staff.
Writer and filmmaker Amy Califa is my guest. Her new book is called Lunch Wars, How to Start a School Food Revolution and Win the Battle for Our Children's Health. We'll resume our conversation in a moment and invite you to call in to join us now. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Writer and filmmaker Amy Califa is my guest. Her new book is called Lunch Wars, How to Start a School Food Revolution and Win the Battle for Our Children's Health. Amy will be in North Texas for a book signing event next Tuesday evening, September 20th, at a Real bookstore in Fairview. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So, Amy, I would imagine there are parents listening out there thinking, well, all of this is too bad for other kids, but they are confident their kids are eating well because they pack their lunches at home. From your own experience, you would say maybe not.
Yes, I was one of those parents, very confident. In fact, you know, I had a child who was already in high school and one in middle school before I even got curious about what was going on in school food, and I did it from a journalistic standpoint, so I thought, well, I'll just check on my daughter's middle school and see how the environment is there. And when I went into the school and spoke with the food service director, they had a computer program that tracks what kids are eating. Now, my daughter was bringing her lunch, and we were feeling very virtuous about that. And I was totally shocked when I read the computer printout that said she'd been eating Pop-Tarts and Rice Krispie treats and French fries and soft drinks on a daily basis. So this was what she'd been buying with her pocket change and the money that we had on account for her for the days when she might forget her lunch. So it made me realize that, you know, often we hear it's the parents' responsibility, and I agree with that, but that the work we were doing at home to teach our kids about good food and good eating habits was really being undermined by what was going on in the schools.
And it's such a shame because, you know, I feel very fortunate that we can afford to have good food at home, and our kids have been exposed to a lot of different kinds of food. But it almost feels to me like when they walk into the school cafeteria that that's undermining the things we're talking about at the house.
Yes, exactly. Those lessons are being undone. And of course, if you're the parent who's feeding your kid well and every other kid in the school is bringing junk food to school or purchasing it in the lunch line, your child is going to feel ostracized. They're going to come home and say, I don't want to bring lunch anymore, or, you know, why do I have to do this? And so it becomes a battle for the parent, and then your child is feeling that they're not mainstream. They get kind of ridiculed. So it's really, it's a tough situation, and that's what motivated me, was I said, why should what we're doing not be the main culture here? Why should the junk food be what's accepted as okay? And I liken it kind of to the tobacco wars of a generation ago, where every public building you went into, people were smoking, and if you didn't want people blowing smoke in your face, well, too bad for you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very similar with what's going on now.
Lest people think that you are just out to get people who work in school food service, you acknowledge in the book many of them care very much about their students. They work very hard. And you point out that it's not really helpful to go in and make enemies out of the staff at the cafeteria. You want to let them know you're an ally.
Yeah, so I think that's, you know, it's kind of a something that in the beginning when the movie first came out, because it's called Two Angry Moms, mm-hmm. it put some people on the defensive, and I had food service directors tell me that, you know, I was making their job more difficult and I didn't understand the system. And once many food service directors saw the movie, they saw that really the heroes of the film are food service directors. And what I'm trying to do with this movement and what many people are trying to do with the movement is support their work and make their jobs more fulfilling and help. You know, everybody cares about child health. I don't think anybody gets into the school food service business because it's so glamorous. So, you know, they in general understand that what parents are trying to do is support something that's good for everybody. And so I suggest that parents, one of the first things they do is visit the school cafeteria and also reach out and talk to the food service director and the people in the kitchens and ask them, what do they need? What kind of help can we give you? And what kind of changes have already been made? You may be surprised that in your district things are already moving in the right direction, and then you can help move it along. I know one dad who went to our middle school asked what they needed, and the woman said, gee, a blender would really help. So, little thing, but made a difference.
Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Lori on the line in Arlington. Hi, Lori.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a comment, or maybe asking for a suggestion. Our food service in Arlington, and recently, or in the last year, had to take out the salad bars in our elementary school because of a federal rule that required any subsidized lunches to have measured quantities of everything. Hmm. And being on a salad bar, you can't measure things. And so unable to satisfy the requirements of this law, the salad bars just went away. And how do I help my food service director get them back?
That is such an interesting comment, Lori, and I'm glad you mentioned it. It's one of the intricacies of the system, and I do explain this in the book. There are different ways that food service can comply with federal guidelines, and that's determined by, you know, really their choice. So some of it is measuring exact quantities. Others is measuring nutrient quantities over a period of a week. But the bottom line there is that salad bars are appearing all around the country. In many school districts, they are completely accepted as what they call a reimbursable meal. That's the meal that meets the government guidelines. And it's important for your food service director to understand that this is a growing trend. It's being used in many places. They have their own organization of food service directors where they can speak with one another and learn how to use that salad bar and meet the government requirements. It's really not that difficult, but it's a matter of educating them as well. So I hope you'll help to do that.
Amy, there may be people listening who say, wait a second, weren't the new round of guidelines from the federal government supposed to fix many of these problems? What's the status of all that, and what did those regulations change?
Well, I think we should all know better than relying on the federal government to fix all the problems in the world, but the regulations have, and they're slowly becoming implemented in the coming year or two, so they haven't all gone into effect. They provide what I call a floor, mm-hmm. not a ceiling. They're minimum requirements, and essentially, to give you the bullets, there's any grain, 50% of all grains are required to be whole grains. So that might be as simple as substituting a whole wheat pizza crust for a white pizza crust, or it might be as sophisticated as serving a quinoa and bean salad, which many people don't even know what quinoa is. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole gamut of compliance with these kinds of regulations. The milk now has to be low-fat or non-fat. Whole milk is no longer allowed in schools. On a plate, instead of having either a vegetable or a fruit, it's required to have a vegetable and a fruit. And there's also now going to be a ceiling on the amount of calories allowed. We used to have minimums, now there's maximums. So these kinds of things address what I call macronutrients, you know, the big basic nutritional building blocks, but they don't address the quality of the food. So when it comes to exactly what the food should look like, that's up to parents, it's up to local school districts, and it's up to local communities to determine how they want the school environment to be. And so I think this is a great opportunity for parents to get involved and advocate on behalf of their kids. It's a grassroots movement.
Now, some people listening might have kids in schools where most of the kids qualify for free or reduced price lunch, and others might be in schools where most of the kids don't. How is this fight different depending on the majority of the students being served in a particular school?
You know, it's different in terms of how a food service director is going to manage their budget and their costs and all of that. But in fact, because it is a national program, the commodities that schools receive from the federal government are going to be offered to the same whether it's a school district in a high poverty area or an affluent area. And very often the purchasing agreements are going to be the same, again, whatever school district they're in. So you're going to find a lot of this highly processed food in every area. And I've seen amazing, wonderful programs in high-poverty areas and in high-privilege areas. So I think this really is solved more by the general will of the community to tackle the issue, just as they tackle, you know, weapons in school or bullying or healthy, you know, dangerous things on the playground. It's something that communities can do when they get together and care about something. It's not, it is about money, but communities are able to find creative ways to fund this program when it becomes important to them.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Kobe in Fort Worth. Hi, Kobe.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is just a wondering how to transition, but I thought if they're given the choice of chicken nuggets, they could maybe they could make it to where there's only a couple, and then you have to have a salad with it, and then they're going to be hungry and eat both.
What do you think, Amy?
I think that's a wonderful suggestion. You know, we have to work with kids where they are. We do have so many children who only will eat chicken nuggets, and, you know, to just take them away and say, here, kid, you're going to eat salad every day, we know it's not going to work. There'll be a rebellion. We have to find ways to work with kids, and every child is different, and this is where the educational piece comes in, and maybe you could convince a chicken nugget addict to try a little chicken on the bone or a little chicken with some kind of a breaded coating, but a real piece of chicken in there and not a mushed up nugget with a gazillion ingredients. So I think what Kobe's saying, that, you know, doing it gradually and making it a process rather than a sudden thing is always more effective.
What sort of investment do processed food companies have in the school lunch business?
Oh, my goodness, a huge investment on many levels. If you go into a school cafeteria today, you will see brand names all over the place. So their goal, and it's been stated, is to get kids when they're young and to develop brand loyalty. And there have been studies done that show children as young as 2 years old will prefer the exact same item if it's in a, you know, colorful branded package, mm-hmm. versus just, you know, having it loose in a bowl. So it advertising marketing is very effective, and it's completely infiltrated schools, and many food service people welcomed it because it solved a lot of the problems that they were having in terms of making ends meet. So this is not something that was done intentionally to harm children. It's only now that we're realizing the health consequences of children eating processed foods on a daily basis.
What about the vending machine issue? Are there federal laws governing what schools can put in and who has access and when?
Well, in fact, that's one of the new regulations that is going into effect, is that all the what's called competitive foods, so that would be foods in vending machines, other foods served in the cafeteria, like those big baskets of chips and cookies, are going to be required to meet certain minimal federal guidelines in terms of nutrition. So their fat content won't be able to exceed 35%. There's going to be decreasing limits on the sodium over the next 10 years. So the goal of that is to at least have help better products in those vending machines. But some school districts are opting to eliminate vending machines altogether, as we discussed earlier, in the effort to have fewer choices and fewer items competing with the healthier meals.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. My guest is writer and filmmaker Amy Califa, whose new book is called Lunch Wars. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Destiny in North Dallas. Hi, Destiny.
Hi. I volunteered last year at my niece and nephew's elementary school, and they were serving fruit, fresh fruit. However, and they were forced to get it, but what I saw is that a lot of children didn't eat it at all. And so because it's already been touched, they couldn't save it for another day or whatever, and all of that stuff was being thrown.
That's frustrating. What do you think,
Amy?
And
I think of some kind of federal regulation, and I was just horrified at all the food that was being thrown, as well as white milk, because they have a choice. Between, I think, like chocolate or strawberry milk and a white milk. And, of course, they went for the sweet milk. And lots of times I saw unopened little cartons of milk being thrown away.
Hmm.
And that's, I don't know what to do. And I also help at a food bank. So I'm just horrified at what's happening.
Yeah, it is horrible, Amy, to see food wasted that someone could and should be eating.
Yeah, Destiny brings up a couple of important points. First of all, you mentioned kids being forced to take the fruit, and you know, the government regulations actually say that you can't force a child to take anything on their tray, so that's really not acceptable. It's nice if it's suggested, because some studies have shown that kids who have a piece of fruit on their plate will eat it if it's there. But as you're saying, kids were throwing it away, and it's a terrible waste. This is where the whole environmental and sustainability education, which is a mandate that's coming to many states soon, can really come into play in a school cafeteria. I've seen schools that compost food waste, and that compost will be used in a school garden or in a municipal area so that the food isn't wasted. It's recycled back into the soil to grow new food. And also, I think it's important, and it's part of how we educate our kids, to get them to taste new things in a setting that's not the noisy, busy cafeteria. So having parents volunteer to go into classrooms and introduce a new food, like a certain kind of fruit, to children in an educational setting, and then that child might discover that they actually do like peaches or watermelons and will be more inclined to have them when they're on the lunch tray. So that's one important thing, is not wasting food. And different school districts use different models where they call it offer versus serve, so that the child will have the choice of taking 3 out of 5 items that meet the federal guidelines for a meal. And then, I'm sorry, I kind of lost my thread. What was the other
chocolate
thing?
And strawberry milk versus white
milk.
Yeah,
that's a huge controversy right now. And it's kind of ironic that it's all boiled down to flavored milk, but I think that's something that can really be handled best by local wellness policy, food policy. And my feeling is, if you're going to serve chocolate milk, read the ingredients on that carton of milk. If a child's going to drink the milk because it's chocolate milk, then make sure that it's a chocolate milk that isn't filled with high fructose corn syrup and all kinds of fillers and thickeners, and that it's an organic source of milk. And so those kinds of things, that just try to get the best quality you can, the least amount of sugar. Kids will eat something very lightly sweetened, and if that's what gets them to drink their milk, and many people feel that milk is an important nutrient, I'm not necessarily in agreement with that, but at least get the healthiest product you can in there.
Writer and filmmaker Amy Califa is my guest. Her new book is called Lunch Wars: How to Start a School Food Revolution and Win the Battle for Our Children's Health. You can join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Amy Califa. Her book is called Lunch Wars: How to Start a School Food Revolution and Win the Battle for Our Children's Health. Her 2007 documentary is called Two Angry Moms. She's going to be in North Texas next Tuesday, the 20th, at 7 o'clock at a Real bookstore in Fairview. If you'd like to join our conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Amy, I want to talk a bit about what I guess you might call extra cafeteria school eating opportunities, you know, mm-hmm. between class parties, and particularly for younger students, food rewards offered mm-hmm. for things like getting your spelling right or behaving properly. I've been frustrated in the past that my kids are so often offered treats at school that I never have the chance to do that as a parent.
Yeah, and I think that's an area where parents really have to step in and get involved either directly in the classroom with the individual teachers. You know, some teachers have their own guidelines for snacks and parties. And often this is a district-wide policy that may exist. I have an example in the book of a mom whose child was in kindergarten, and they had a math exercise of counting to 100 by tens, and every item that they were counting with was a candy. And she was so distressed about it, and she called me, and she'd already made enemies with the room mother for speaking out about it. Her child got uninvited to a play date with mm-hmm. the woman's kid. And then I suggested that she go to the Board of Education and the school superintendent and find out what the policy is. And in fact, when she read the wellness policy, it very specifically said that food was not to be used as a classroom reward. And so she showed that to the teacher, And they had to resolve the matter. They had to find substitutes. And so she still wasn't very popular, but there was a policy in place that actually dealt with this. Other school districts have policies regarding birthday parties. Texas is the heart of the cupcake wars.
Mm-hmm.
So it is something that each district can determine. And I've seen some very sane policies where they'll say, okay, no treats before lunch, or we're only going to do one birthday party a month, so all the kids who have a birthday party in September are going to celebrate it on one day. Or here are the items that we do allow parents to send in as a treat on a birthday. So there's a lot of different ways to solve this, and parents can get involved on their district level to find out what the policy is, and they can sit on a wellness committee if they want to help change the policy.
You know, those alternative strategies seem to raise a lot less ire than the out-and-out bans, because people get, in this country, when we're told we absolutely cannot do something, then somehow we want to do it more than anything.
Exactly. There's nothing that strikes outrage more than a ban, and it's also a really negative attitude toward food, and it creates a lot of food phobias that, we see among adults, to say this is bad, you can't this, you can't that, rather than celebrating all the great, wonderful, good food there is out there. And we have such an ethnically diverse culture here in America. And it's really fun when we can bring that into the schools. And I've seen school districts where once a month they have a theme night where they invite families into the cafeteria and we'll create a menu from foods of a certain country or region and do it as a potluck. And then it becomes more of a celebration of food, and children are exposed to different kinds of foods, different flavors, different tastes. It's a much healthier way to approach food than saying you can't, you shouldn't, this is terrible.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Josh in Cedar Hill. Hi, Josh.
Hey, my name is Josh. I'm a student teacher right now, and the school where I'm doing my student teaching, my teacher will only allow her students to eat snacks in the classroom if it is a healthy snack. It's not a school policy, but it's something, a list of foods that she has approved. Say if they bring a candy bar or something like that, she won't allow them to eat it until lunch when they're on their own time. But when they're on her time, they can only eat healthy food. I was wondering how your guests felt about that.
I think it's wonderful that the teacher has such a concern for the education that her children are getting at school about food. And so it's not that she's banning it outright, like you said, that the children can eat that when it's on their own time. But she doesn't want that in her classroom because it sets an example, and by allowing it, it's saying that she thinks that's okay, and obviously she doesn't think that's okay. So this is a lesson that her children are going to learn in the classroom, and they may, in fact, take that back home to their parents and say, I don't want to bring a candy bar because I'm not allowed to eat it in class, and can I have a different snack? And it's not a punishment. It's really saying this is something that should be up to the parents to do on their own time. And like Chris said earlier, if you want to give your child a junky snack, and I certainly do that too, it should be up to the parents to do that. The school should be efforting to provide things that are only healthy to kids. We don't let them play on toxic playground equipment. Why would we encourage that in the food world at school?
Let's go back to the phones now. And this time we have Tala on the line from Denton. Hi, Tala.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a quick question. Growing up as a kid, I remember I wasn't allowed to eat most of the food due to, religious reasons or health reasons and stuff like that. And I was wondering how schools could, attend to issues for students who, for whatever reason, can't have what's on the menu. And that's it.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, that's a big issue now for, as you said, for health reasons, for religious reasons. There are, I think, double the amount of children with food allergies and sensitivities now than there were a generation ago. So in a typical classroom, we're seeing several students who have allergies to foods that are served in school, some of them, life-threatening kinds of allergies. And schools have to deal with this. They're required to. And one of the ways that they're doing this is by they're required now to give parents lists of all the ingredients that are in the foods that are served. So, for example, I have a printout of a grilled cheese sandwich. If I had a child with a peanut allergy or a soy allergy, I would probably say, well, eat the grilled cheese sandwich. But, in fact, there's soy in the bread and there's soy in the cheese. So having access to those lists of ingredients are very, very important for children, for parents to be able to protect their children against allergies or, you know, any other reasons they may not want. You know, if your child's a vegetarian, there might be something that's a meat extract also in a food that might look like vegetarian. So it's really important because foods are so highly processed to be able to see what exactly is in them. And you can ask your district food service director for those lists of ingredients.
I've heard stories from parents whose children have severe food allergies about other parents thinking, well, what's the big deal if my kid takes a peanut butter sandwich and your kid doesn't have to eat it? And can you talk a little bit about the best ways to maybe, just within one's own classroom, educate other parents to help, you know, sort of protect a child that has a really serious problem?
Yeah, when my daughter was in school, there was a boy in her class that had one of those life-threatening peanut allergies, and his mom was just such a tireless advocate. And I have to confess, when I started my child in first grade, I wasn't thinking at all about school food. And so we would look at a mom like that as somewhat extreme, but she knew how dangerous this was for her son, and she took it upon herself to pass out lists of healthy, not just healthy, but safe snacks mm-hmm. that parents could send in to school with their child. And she advocated, and they were able to set up what they called a peanut-free table in the cafeteria. So if your child was going to eat at this table, they would have to make sure that they didn't have a peanut butter and jelly sandwich with them or anything that had a tree nut in it. And after a couple years, the parents and the students just got used to this, and we'd get her little handout every year, and we'd say, okay, fine, this is what we can bring. And there were plenty of options, and so we all just got used to it.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Kelly in Dallas. Hey, Kelly.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I'm a stay-at-home dad, and I make all the meals for my children that they take to school. And my concerns about that were sort of honed to a razor-fine edge about a year ago when I found out that my daughter had a lot of food allergies, the most severe of which are dairy and sugar. And I was profoundly influenced by the writings of two authors, and I'm wondering if you're familiar with them, what your comments on them are, Michael Pollan and The Omnivore's Dilemma, and particularly Gary Taubes, who wrote Good Calories, Bad Calories, and Why We Get Fat. And Taubes' work essentially turns the USDA food pyramid on its head, and it was an absolute revelation for me to read his book and his view on what it is that's healthy to eat. So I wonder, have you read those authors' works, and what do you think about them if you have?
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thanks. I'm a huge fan of Michael Pollan. I think his writing is so accessible. I always feel like he is able to write what's in my mind that I can't articulate so well. So it's great to read anything he writes. And he's got some, you know, The Omnivore's Dilemma is a big, fat book, but he's also got some much simpler books that really give you some very straightforward rules that are exactly, as the caller said, kind of shocking. Gary Taubes, I've only read reviews of his work, and I apologize because I haven't read his book, but it sounds wonderful. And I think this is a case of the more we educate ourselves about nutrition and we don't accept all our nutrition information from the food manufacturers, the more we get an eye-opening shock when we hear what actually might be good for us that we've been told is bad for so long. I mean, even things like cholesterol is very controversial, although most Americans believe cholesterol is bad. And other kinds of fat, we all need fat, and especially growing children need good fat for their brains. So it's very important to understand, you know, that the food industry has vilified fat, and now we're hearing that all carbs are bad. So these kinds of things, we pick these food villains and everybody gets on the bandwagon. But the more you know about actual nutrition, the more you realize that it's whole foods, it's real foods, it's how they're grown. The milk from a cow that's been raised on pasture, the meat from a cow that's been raised on pasture is so different from that of an animal that's been fed in confinement grains that have made them sick. And it that quality will affect the children's bodies that consume it as well. So we really all need to educate ourselves on this topic, and those are two wonderful writers to read about.
You, of course, don't argue with the need for children and, in fact, everybody to have regular daily exercise, but you do take issue with the campaign by some food marketing companies to say that the obesity crisis is almost entirely a factor of not enough exercise as opposed to what we're eating.
Yeah, you know, when the crisis in childhood obesity became a topic for discussion in the media, the food manufacturers, the beverage companies were very, very quick to jump on the exercise bandwagon and sponsor walkathons and, you know, those kinds of things and pass out pedometers.
You could get them at McDonald's for a while.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. We just need to walk more. We need to run more. We need to exercise. But what happens is there's a whole cycle that takes place when a child is fed, you know, foods that are calorie-dense but nutrient-poor. They not only do they gain weight and show physical signs of obesity, they develop chronic conditions, and type 2 diabetes is one of them that we hear about, but other kinds of chronic conditions that makes them feel just lazy and lethargic, and they can't think well. And so we can't expect this child to get up and, you know, start running marathons. And, you know, there's also other issues in a lot of urban places where children don't have the opportunity to play outside. So I think exercise is absolutely key, but a child who's fed well with really fresh, delicious, healthy food is going to be much more inclined to get off that couch and away from the computer and get some exercise. So it's got to work both ways.
What does it take to get other moms and dads and maybe school administrators to join you in your lunch war so you're not just battling alone?
Yeah, it's, you know, that's why I wrote the book. I got email from so many parents who said, what can I do, what can I do? And there are very simple things you can do, like volunteering in a school garden. You don't have to lead the revolution. We need lots of people to help out. So simply find somebody else in your community who cares about this issue. Ask at the school, ask the administration, what can I do to get involved? And if there isn't something already going on in your community, I encourage people to find support online. I have a website. It's called angrymoms.org. And there's a way to connect with people by zip code there if you join. It's like a social network. And the other thing is I made the movie Two Angry Moms to get the conversation started. So if you get a copy of the DVD, you can host a screening in your living room, at a PTA meeting, at a town library. And it attracts like-minded people. It's so much easier to do this when you're in a group, and then everybody can kind of take a different role and do what they're good at, but find ways to advocate, and it doesn't have to be the person sitting on the wellness committee, although we need those people too. It can be working with local farmers, trying to find out how we can source from them and finding out what's missing in terms of getting the food to the school or whatever it is. So you can just take a small role, and it'll make a big difference.
Amy Califa's new book is called Lunch Wars, How to Start a School Food Revolution and Win the Battle for Our Children's Health. She'll be in North Texas next Tuesday, September 20th, at a Real bookstore in Fairview. Amy, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Well, thanks for having me on the show, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.